tricked and fooled. Then there will be nothing but trouble for you. You must make your mind smooth. If your mind is not resilient, you will be easily startled. You will be easily frightened. You will try to think quickly, but you won't think clearly. You yourself will stand in the way of your own mind. You yourself will block it. Then there will be trouble for you. You must make your own mind resilient. If your mind is not steady, you will be easily angered and upset. You will be arrogant and proud. You will look down on other people. You will envy them and desire their possessions. You will speak about them without thinking. You will complain about them, gossip about them, criticize them. You will lust after their women. People will come to despise you. They will pay someone to use his power on you. They will want to kill you. Then there will be nothing but trouble for you. You must make your mind steady. You must learn to forget about yourself. If you make your mind smooth, you will have a long life. Your trail will extend a long way. You will be prepared for danger wherever you go. You will see it in your mind before it happens. How will you walk along this trail of wisdom? Well, you will go to many places. You must look at them closely. You must remember all of them. Your relatives will talk to you about them. You must remember everything they tell you. You must think about it, and keep on thinking about it, and keep on thinking about it. You must do this because no one can help you but yourself. If you do this, your mind will become smooth. It will become steady and resilient. You will stay away from trouble. You will walk a long way and live a long time. Wisdom sits in places. It's like water that never dries up. You need to drink water to stay alive, don't you? Well, you also need to drink from places. You must remember everything about them. You must learn their names. You must remember what happened at them long ago. You must think about it and keep on thinking about it. Then your mind will become smoother and smoother. Then you will see danger before it happens. You will walk a long way and live a long time. You will be wise. People will respect you. Vroom. Rising to his feet, without another word, Dudley walks away in the direction of his outhouse. His suspicions were correct. I've had trouble grasping his statement on wisdom. No one from Cibicue has broached this subject with me before, and few have spoken with such eloquence and grace. I am moved by what I have heard, but uncertain of what to make of it, and understandably so. Dudley delivered his comments in a distinctive verbal register characterized by conspicuous grammatical parallelism, marked lexical redundancy, and the measured repetition of several dominant metaphors. This resembles the language of Western Apache prayer, and therein lies one of my problems. While the economy of Dudley's speech rendered portions of his statement readily accessible, the metaphors that anchored it, boldly figured, densely compressed, and probably very old, stood well beyond my reach. What, for example, is a smooth mind, a resilient mind, a steady mind? There is another problem as well. I can safely assume that Dudley's account was supported throughout by a covert cultural logic that imbued its claims with validity and truth, yet it is unclear to me what that logic is. What sort of reasoning supports the assertion that wisdom sits in places, or that wisdom is like water, or that drinking from places, whatever that is, requires knowledge of place names and stories of past events. Maybe I have gotten in over my head. Dudley's statement caught me off guard and has left me feeling unmoored. For a split second, I imagine myself a small, uprooted plant, bouncing crazily through the air on a whirlwind made of ancient Apache tropes. When Dudley returns, he is smiling. "Did you understand?" I shake my head. "No, not much." Ruth is also smiling. She is standing in the doorway and looks fully recovered from her bout with nostalgia. She has combed her hair and is sporting the triumphant look of one who knew all along. "I told you," she said sharply. "It's difficult. Now my brother has made you think too much. Now your brain is really tired. Now you look kind of sick." Ruth's assessment of my mental and physical condition does little to improve it, and I look to Dudley for help. "I gave you too much at once," he says. "You just need to think about it." Ruth agrees. "That's right. You really need to think about it." Then she flashes her broadest smile and tells us our food is ready. But before we go inside, Ruth presents us with a suggestion. On the coming weekend, when the horsemen will be off work, Dudley and I will catch up our horses and go for a ride. It might last all day, so we will need to take food. Ruth will provide the fresh tortillas. I will contribute 2 cans of sardines, a box of Ritz crackers, a slab of Longhorn cheese, and 4 bottles of Barg's root beer. Dudley will take me to different places, teach me their names, and tell me what happened at them long ago. Then, maybe, I will understand something. When we get back home, Dudley will speak to me in English. "Boy, Keys, I'll see you sometime." Then he will leave me alone to think. In return for these services, he will receive 2 sacks of flour, 2 cans of MJB coffee, 1 sack of sugar, a pail of Crisco, and $20 cash. Now, what about it? For all her endearing qualities, and she has them in abundance, Ruth Patterson is not a person to challenge when her mind is made up. And Dudley, who on prior occasions has pointed this out himself, wastes no time in endorsing her plan. "Neither do I." "Good," says Ruth, whose reputation also embraces an unswerving willingness to capitalize on promising business opportunities whenever they arise. "Good," she says again. "My brother will help you out. I think you'll really like it." Wisdom Sits in Places. June 15, 1982. Even the most experienced horsemen occasionally get hurt. That is what people say as news of Dudley's mishap circulates through Cibecue. Yesterday, trailing the spotted maverick bull with poor eyesight at the base of a rocky slope named Tse Des Chie, Long Red Ridge, Dudley's mare lost her footing, went down hard, and abandoned her rider to walk home with bruised ribs, a dislocated shoulder, and a badly swollen lip. Dudley's first concern was for the welfare of the mare, who returned to her pasture later in the day with nothing more than a few minor scrapes and a glassy look in her eye. This morning, wrapped in a homemade sling that keeps slipping off, Dudley is stiff and sore and in excellent spirits. We sit on the porch of his house as visitors come and go. Ruth has launched a get-well campaign whose main objectives are to accumulate gifts of thick beef broth and to surround her brother with as many children as possible. The children come in shifts to stand beside his chair. He tells them the story of his mishap, and their eyes grow wide with excitement. And he smiles, his warmest smile, and tells them to be careful around horses and cattle. A little girl steps forward and gives him her orange popsicle. As I stand to leave, Dudley tells me to come back tomorrow. Things will be less busy, and we can speak again of matters raised before. I accept his invitation. A small boy approaches his chair and hands him a piece of bubble gum. Dudley is delighted. Ruth's campaign is already a success. Dudley will rejoin the horsemen in less than a week. Our ride together has been postponed. June 16th through 19th, 1982. For the next 4 days, drinking coffee, watching ants, and pausing now and then to speak of other things, Dudley and I engaged in a series of conversations about his earlier statement on wisdom and places. At my request, we began by examining some of the statement's linguistic features, focusing attention on the morphology and semantics of its several primary tropes. We then moved on to consider the internal logic of Dudley's account, exploring in some detail the culturally based assumptions that invest its claims with coherence and credible sense. Our discussions dealt with fairly abstract matters, and now and again, when Dudley sensed his pupil was getting muddled, he responded by telling stories that linked his generalizations to illustrative sets of particulars. It soon became apparent that Apache conceptions of wisdom differ markedly from those contained in Western ideologies. More interesting was the discovery that the former are grounded in an informal theory of mind, which asserts that wisdom arises from a small set of antecedent conditions. Because these conditions are also qualities of mind, and because they vary from mind to mind, the theory explains why some people are wiser than others. Stated in general terms, the Apache theory holds that wisdom, Igoyai, consists in a heightened mental capacity that facilitates the avoidance of harmful events by detecting threatening circumstances when none are apparent. This capacity for prescient thinking is produced and sustained by three mental conditions, described in Apache as Dinigodilko, smoothness of mind, Binigodlis, resilience of mind, and binigotlzil, steadiness of mind. Because none of these conditions is given at birth, each must be cultivated in a conscientious manner by acquiring relevant bodies of knowledge and applying them critically to the workings of one's mind. Knowledge of places and their cultural significance is crucial in this regard because it illustrates with numerous examples the mental conditions needed for wisdom as well as the practical advantages that wisdom confers on persons who possess it. Contained in stories attributed to the ancestors, knowledge of places thus embodies an unformalized model of Igoyai and an authoritative rationale for seeking to attain it. Although some Apache people embrace this knowledge eagerly and commit it to memory in exhaustive detail, others are less successful, and while some are able to apply it productively to their minds, many experience difficulty. Consequently, in any Apache community at any point in time, wisdom is present in varying degrees, and only a few persons are ever completely wise. By virtue of their unusual mental powers, wise men and women are able to foresee disaster, fend off misfortune, and avoid explosive conflicts with other persons. For these and other reasons, they are highly respected and often live to be very old. Likened to water, because of its life-sustaining properties, wisdom is viewed first and foremost as an instrument of survival. Although Western Apaches distinguish clearly between an individual's mind, bini, and his or her brain, bitsiga, both are described with a classificatory verb stem, ah, that designates portable objects whose shape is roundish and compact. However, only bini can be modified with adjectival constructions beginning with the prefix go, space, area, an instructive bit of morphology which indicates that the mind is conceived of as a region within the brain. This notion is illustrated by the expression bini kodoko, smoothness of mind, which identifies the primary mental condition required for wisdom. When the adjective dilko is used without prefixes, it serves to describe the texture of smooth and even surfaces, such as a pane of glass or a piece of varnished wood. But when dilko is combined with go, it conveys the sense of cleared space, of area free of obstructions, such as an agricultural field from which all vegetation has been carefully removed. This is the sense in which godilko is used in the Apache metaphor of the smooth mind. Like cleared plots of ground, smooth minds are unobstructed, uncluttered, and unfettered, a quality which permits them to observe and reason with penetrating clarity. Skeptical of outward appearances, smooth minds are able to look through them and beyond them to detect obscured realities and hidden possibilities. Unencumbered by obstacles to insightful thinking, smooth minds see danger before it happens and trouble before it comes. Thus does wisdom flourish. Mental smoothness is believed by Apaches to be the product of two subsidiary conditions, mental resilience and mental steadiness, which ward off distractions that interfere with calm and focused thought. These distractions are grouped into two broad classes according to whether their sources are external or internal to the individual. Resilience of mind, bini kontolis, combats those of the external variety, while steadiness of mind, bini gonadzil, works to eliminate the internal kind. Turning to the first of these expressions, it should be noted that the adjective ntlis is used alone in the familiar sense of hard, thus describing a wide array of objects whose rigid surfaces resist damage and destruction from outside forces. But when ntlis is combined with the spatial prefix go, the resulting construction gontlis takes on a meaning equivalent to an enclosed space that holds its shape. A tightly woven basket, yielding but strong, is properly described as gontlis, as is an inflatable vinyl ball or a flexible cardboard box that withstands the weight of a child. And so, too, is a resilient human mind. Resistant to the unnerving effects of jarring external events, resilient minds protect their interior spaces by shielding them from outside disruptions that threaten quiescent thinking. Mental smoothness is thereby promoted and preserved. According to Dudley Patterson, fear and alarm present the greatest threats to maintaining mental resilience. Being aware of this, resilient minds guard themselves against shock and consternation, keeping these reactions at bay by centering themselves on what must be done to deal with the problem at hand. Resilient minds do not give in to panic or fall prey to spasms of anxiety or succumb to spells of crippling worry. Largely immune to emotional turbulence, they do not become agitated or disoriented, even in terrifying circumstances. Resilient minds maintain their ability to reason clearly and thus neither block themselves nor stand in their own way. While resilience of mind contributes to mental smoothness by blunting the effects of external distractions, steadiness of mind, bini gonadzil, accomplishes this objective by removing the sources of internal ones. The sense of steady conveyed by the adjective unldzil is that which one associates with a post driven firmly into the ground. The post is stable, it does not wobble, and therefore it is reliable. But the post itself is not responsible for these desirable attributes. As interpreted by Apaches, the post's steadiness is imparted by the hole in which it is lodged, And this is the notion, a supportive and accommodating space, that is evoked by the form, Gonaldziel. Conceived of and described in analogous terms, steady human minds maintain themselves in a manner that ensures their own stability and reliability. This is achieved by relinquishing all thoughts of personal superiority and by eliminating aggressive feelings toward fellow human beings. As a result, steady minds are unhampered by feelings of arrogance or pride, anger or vindictiveness, jealousy or lust, all of which present serious hindrances to calm and measured thinking. Because the essence of mental steadiness lies in a capacity to do away with self-serving emotions that exploit or demean the worth of other people, wise men and women rarely encounter serious interpersonal problems. Free of conceit and hostile ambitions, steady minds forget about themselves and conduct their social affairs in harmony and peace. Except for the mentally impaired, every Apache who enters the world can legitimately aspire to wisdom. Yet none is born with the three conditions of mind required for wisdom to flourish. Cultivating these conditions, a long and uneven process involving much introspection and many disheartening setbacks, has both private and public aspects. On the one hand, it is the responsibility of the individuals to critically assess their own minds and prepare them for wisdom by cultivating the qualities of smoothness, resilience, and steadiness. On the other hand, instruction is needed from persons sympathetic to the endeavor who have pursued it themselves with a measure of success. Although instruction may begin at any age, it usually commences when pre-adolescent children become aware that adult life entails an endless flow of demands that need to be met with special skills and abilities. Young people who have reached this level of understanding are told to be constantly alert to what goes on around them, to remember everything they observe, and to report on anything out of the ordinary. They are also urged to pay close attention to the words and actions of older people whose general demeanor is deemed worthy of emulation. And they are regularly invited to travel, especially in the company of persons who will speak to them about the places they see and visit. It is on these excursions that the relationship between places and wisdom is first made explicit. Drink from places, Apache boys and girls are told, then you can work on your mind. This view of mental development rests on the premise that knowledge is useful to the extent that it can be swiftly recalled and turned without effort into practical ends. A related premise is that objects whose appearance is unique are more easily recalled than those that look alike. It follows from these assumptions that because places are visually unique, a fact both marked and affirmed by their possession of separate names, they serve an excellent vehicle for recalling useful knowledge. And because the knowledge needed for wisdom is nothing if not useful, the adage, wisdom sits in places, iyogai goza sika, is seen to make perfect sense. But there is more to the adage than truth and logical consistency. The verb, sika, it sits, incorporates a classificatory stem, ka, that applies exclusively to rigid containers and their contents. The prototype of this category is a watertight vessel, and thus the adage creates an image of places as durable receptacles and the knowledge required for wisdom as a lasting supply of water resting securely within them. This same image supports the assertions that preparing one's mind for wisdom is akin to a form of drinking, and that wisdom, like water, is basic to survival. As Dudley Patterson remarked during one of our conversations, You can't live long without water, and you can't live a long time without wisdom. You need to drink both. The knowledge on which wisdom depends is gained from observing different places, thus to recall them quickly and clearly, learning their Apache names, thus to identify them in spoken discourse and in song, and reflecting on traditional narratives that underscore the virtues of wisdom by showing what can happen when its facilitating conditions are absent. Drawn from different story genres, these narratives juxtapose a character whose mind is insightfully smooth with one or more characters whose minds are not. Distracted by troubling events or excited at the prospect of achieving selfish gains, characters of the latter type fail to understand the true nature of their situation and perform impulsive acts that bring them and others to the brink of disaster. In sharp contrast, characters of the former type remain calm and unperturbed, grasp the situation for what it really is, and avert misfortune by exercising the clear and wary vision that is the hallmark of wisdom. The social group survives, shaken but whole, and the qualities of mind responsible for its continuation are made clear for all to see. Wisdom has triumphed over stupidity and foolishness, and the difference between them, a difference sometimes as large as life and death itself, cannot be ignored. The two stories that follow were offered by Dudley Patterson to illustrate these themes. The first story deals with serious problems stemming from a lack of mental resilience. The second depicts a near catastrophe brought on by a lack of mental steadiness. In both stories, alarm and confusion run rampant until mental smoothness, accompanied by wisdom, comes to the rescue in the very nick of time. Long ago, some people went to gather acorns. They camped at Tse Naztie, line of rocks circles around. They gathered lots of acorns near Tse Ditlige Naditine. Trail extends across scorched rocks. They almost had enough, but they went on anyway. They were going to Kaicho Oaha. Big willow stands alone. They stopped on their way where the trail crossed a shallow stream. They had been walking fast and were very thirsty. They wanted to drink. It was hot. Then their leader said to them, "Don't drink unless I tell you to. I want to look around here first." He went off. Their leader was wise. He saw danger in his mind. Then, as soon as he was gone, a young woman said, "My children are very thirsty. They need to drink. This water looks safe to me. I'm going to drink it." The others agreed with her. "Yes," they said, "we must drink. This water looks good." So they started drinking. Then, pretty soon, they began to get sick. They got dizzy and began to vomit violently. All of them got sick, including the children. They got sicker. They vomited and vomited. They were scared that they were dying. They were crying out in pain, crying out in fear. Their leader was the only one who didn't drink. He walked upstream and looked on the ground. There were fresh tracks by the stream, and he saw where Coyote had pissed on a flat rock that slanted into the water. Drops of Coyote's piss were still running off the rock into the water. Then he went back to his people. "Stop," he told them. "Don't drink that water. It's no good. Coyote has pissed in it. That's why all of you are sick." Then one of those people said, "We didn't know. We were thirsty. The water looked safe. We were in a hurry and it didn't look dangerous." Those people trusted their eyes. They should have waited until their leader had finished looking around. One of the children nearly died. That's how that crossing got its name. After that, they called it Ma Tehilise, Coyote Pisses in the Water. and again. Long ago, here at Cibecue, just when the corn was coming up, an old man saw a black cloud in the sky. It was moving towards him. He watched the cloud come closer and closer. It was made up of grasshoppers, a huge swarm of grasshoppers. Soon, they were eating the corn shoots. Ch-izid, ch-izid. It sounded like that. Then the old man got worried. If this is allowed to continue, we will have nothing to eat. All of our medicine men should work together on this for us. That old man was wise. He had seen danger in his mind. His mind was smooth. He knew what had to be done. Then he spoke to some people, and they went to the camp of a medicine man with strong power. The old man spoke to him. Something terrible is happening to us. All of our medicine men should work together on this for us. Then the medicine man said to them, "What you say is true, but I will work alone. I will pray and sing. I will help you. I will bring a great rainstorm to kill these grasshoppers." Then, that same evening, he started to sing. He sang throughout the night, but nothing happened. There was no rain. In the morning, there were no clouds in the sky. The grasshoppers were still eating the corn. Ch-izid, ch-izid. Then, that medicine man sang alone again. He sang all night. "I will bring lots of heavy rain," he told the people. But still, there was nothing. In the morning, there were still no clouds in the sky. Ch-izid, ch-izid. Then another medicine man went to him and said, "We should work together on this. Something very bad is happening. If four of us sing together, we can bring heavy rains and destroy these grasshoppers." Then the first medicine man thought about it. "No," he said. "The people came first to me. I will bring heavy rain if I sing four times alone." So he started to sing again. He sang all night. It was the same as before. Nothing happened. Those grasshoppers were still eating the corn. Ch-izid. Now, the people were very frightened. Some were crying out in fear. They saw what was happening to their corn. Then that medicine man sang one more time alone, and still there was no rain. Then four medicine men got together. "That old man was right. We should have worked on this together. Let's get ready. We'll start tonight." That man who sings alone is far too proud. His mind is not smooth. He thinks only of himself. Then those four medicine men started singing. They sang together throughout the night. They didn't stop to rest. They didn't stop to drink. They kept singing, 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 all through the night. Then, early in the morning, there was a loud clap of thunder. It started to rain. It rained harder. It rained harder and harder. It rained still harder. It rained for 4 days and four nights. The people were afraid. They thought their homes might be swept away. Then, it stopped raining. An old woman went outside and looked around. Everywhere there were dead grasshoppers. Their bodies covered the ground. The ground was dark with them. Then that old woman started to walk to her cornfield. To get there, she had to cross a wide arroyo. When she got there, she saw a long pile of dead grasshoppers reaching from one side to the other. "Grasshoppers piled up across," she said. Then that old woman knew these four medicine men had worked together well. Then that old woman went back and told the people what she had seen. "We have very little corn left," they said. "Most of it has been eaten. We will surely get weak from hunger. All of us will suffer because of one proud man." Afterward, they called that place Naishchagi, Na Des Aha, grasshoppers piled up across. While cautionary narratives like these are appreciated by Apaches for their aesthetic merits, their hard-edged terseness, steady forward motion, and mounting suspense can be exploited by gifted storytellers to gripping effect. They are valued primarily as instruments of edification. For persons seeking wisdom, such stories provide time-honored standards for identifying mental flaws and weaknesses, thereby revealing where remedial work is needed and often instilling a desire to perform it. This kind of self-reflexive activity, which is described in Apache as bini nayik e izig, working on one's mind, is understood to be a drawn-out affair that becomes less and less difficult as it becomes increasingly habitual. For it only stands to reason that the more one scrutinizes one's mind, and the more one acts to improve it by reflecting on narratives that exemplify the conditions necessary for wisdom, the greater the likelihood that wisdom will develop. Disciplined mental effort, diligently sustained, will eventually give rise to a permanent state of mind. Despite this encouraging premise, which for many Apaches is a source of early confidence, the trail of wisdom is known to be fraught with pitfalls. The human mind is a vulnerable space, and protecting it against obstacles that threaten incisive thinking is a formidable task. Life is full of alarming events, deaths, fights, illnesses, frightening dreams, the nefarious doings of ghosts and witches, and the forces of fear are hard to overcome. One tries to surmount them, and later one tries again, but repeated failures take their toll, and attaining the goal of mental resilience begins to look unlikely. Just as difficult is the challenge of ridding one's mind of self-centered thoughts that find expression in harsh and heated ways, antagonizing other people and causing them to retaliate with aggressions of their own. Again, one makes determined efforts, and again they fall short, and again one must deal with uncertainty and doubt. Mental steadiness joins mental resilience in seeming out of reach. And then there is the never-ending problem of everything else. When one is caught up in the demanding swirl of daily life, caring for children, keeping peace with relatives, trying to get by on very little money, pursuing the trail of wisdom can become just another burden. There is enough to do already without thinking about places and working on one's mind. And so it happens, often with reluctance but also with a welcome sense of relief, that the work is abandoned. At different points on the trail of wisdom, Apache men and women simply decide to stop. They have traveled as far as they are able or willing to go. Wisdom, they have learned, is more easily imagined than achieved. But a handful of persons resolve to persevere, undaunted by the shortcomings of their minds. They keep striving to refine them. Committing to memory more and more cautionary narratives, dwelling on their implications at deeper and deeper levels, and visiting the places with which they are associated as opportunities arise. Little is said of these activities, and progress reports are neither offered nor requested, but progress reports, as Dudley Patterson was quick to point out, are usually unnecessary. As people move forward on the trail of wisdom, their behavior begins to change. And these alterations, which become steadily more apparent as time goes on, can be readily observed by relatives and friends. More noticeably, inner strides towards mental smoothness are reflected in outer displays of poise and equanimity. Signs of nervousness fade, irritability subsides, outbursts of temper decline. There is also to be detected a growing consistency among attitudes adopted, opinions expressed, and judgments proffered personal points of view built upon consonant themes cohere and take definite shape, and there is increasing correspondence between spoken words and subsequent deeds. Promises made are promises kept. Pledges extended are pledges fulfilled. Projects proposed are projects undertaken. As Apache men and women advance farther along the trail of wisdom, their composure continues to deepen. Increasingly quiet and self-possessed, they rarely show signs of fear or alarm. More and more magnanimous, they seldom get angry or upset. And more than ever, they are watchful and observant. Their minds, resilient and steady at last, are very nearly smooth, and it shows in obvious ways. And always these people are thinking of place-centered narratives, thinking of the ancestors who first gave them voice, and thinking of how to apply their circumstances in their own lives. Having passed the point where cautionary narratives are mainly useful for disclosing mental weaknesses, these people now consult the stories as guides for what to do and what not to do in specific situations. As described by Dudley Patterson, what typically happens is this. Something unusual occurs, an event or a series of events that is judged to be similar or analogous to incidents described in one of the stories. Unless these similarities can be dismissed as superficial, they stimulate further thought, leading the thinker to treat the story as a possible aid for planning his or her own course of action. This is accomplished by picturing in one's mind the exact location where the narrated events unfolded and imagining oneself as actually taking part in them, always in the role of a story character who is shown to be wise. If a powerful sense of identification with that character ensues, if, as some Apaches put it, thinker and character flow swiftly together, Ndugo, Idnuli, the experience is taken to confirm that the narrative in question will be helpful in dealing with the situation at hand. If this sort of identification fails to occur, the narrative is discarded and other stories, potentially more instructive, are consulted in similar fashion. It is important to understand that wise men and women are able to consult dozens of cautionary narratives in very short periods of time. Such concentrated effort is not required of them under ordinary circumstances, but when a crisis appears to be looming, they set about it immediately. Serene and undistracted, they start drinking from places. In times of emergency, they are said to gulp from them. And soon enough, often within minutes, they have seen in their minds what needs to be done. Wisdom has finally shown its hand, and when it does, as Dudley Patterson remarked in English the day he cast off his sling and prepared to rejoin the horsemen, "It's sure pretty good, all right." "Yes," he said thoughtfully, "that's sure pretty good, all right." Our ancestors did that. August 10th, 1982. But for a gate left carelessly open, and some 30 head of cattle that soon passed through it to loose themselves in a tumbled maze of rock-strewn buttes, meandering arroyos, and dry box canyons, my instructional ride with Dudley Patterson might have proceeded as planned. The day began on a calm and peaceful note. We mounted our horses shortly after dawn, rode out of Cibecue on a trail leading north, and then turned east as the rising sun, a brilliant crimson ball, moved into view above a tree-covered ridge. The morning air was crisp and cool, and all one could hear was the comforting squeak of saddle leather and the hooves of the horses striking softly into the earth. A red-tailed hawk banked on the wind in a vast blue sky. After lighting a cigarette with his antique Zippo, Dudley broke the silence. Do you see that ridge over there? We call it Tse Dotelishi de Zaha, Turquoise Ridge. My grandmother took her family there when the smallpox came in 1922. So many people died, it was terrible. My grandmother was a medicine woman and knew what to do. She prayed each morning as the sun came up. Day after day she prayed. All of her children survived the sickness. And the ravine over there? The one with long white boulders on the far side? Its name is Nagoschid Tu Haigede. Badger scoops up water. Badger lived there a long time ago, next to a spring where he went to drink. There was no daylight then, and the people were having a hard time. Badger and Bear wanted to keep it that way. They liked the darkness, but Coyote outsmarted them. He gambled with them and won daylight for the people. They gambled up ahead where those four round hills sit in a row. Those hills are named Dailt'ane, the mounds. And way over there, that little clump of trees, we call it Te'is Sikade, Grove of Cottonwood Trees. There's a spring there, too. It used to give lots of water, but now it's almost dry. Nick Thompson's mother camped there with her parents when she was a young girl. One time an airplane went shooting by. She didn't know what it was. She crawled under a bush and covered her face with her hands. Her body was trembling all over. She stayed under the bush for 2 days, trembling. And that red bluff over there? Dudley stopped speaking. Two riders have appeared in the distance and are moving toward us at a fast trot. Minutes later, Sam Enfield and Charles Cromwell rein in their mounts and deliver the troubling news. Someone forgot to close the gate near the top of Hayagokije, Spotted Slope, and a large bunch of cattle, cows, calves, and the spotted maverick bull with one bad eye, has moved into the torturous country behind Kidotije, Blue House. Judging from their tracks, the cattle crossed over yesterday afternoon. They should be rounded up without delay. Otherwise, they will scatter over a wider area and make the job more difficult. Dudley listens quietly, points once with his lips in the direction of Blue House, and off we go, to spend the next 7 hours searching for wily creatures keenly uninterested in letting themselves be found. A day of quiet learning turns into a punishing game of hide-and-go-seek, and no one finds it the least bit enjoyable. But slowly the work gets done. The open gate is wired shut, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, most of the cattle are back where they belong. Only the spotted maverick bull is missing. His tracks disappear at the head of a narrow canyon. Dudley is unconcerned. The bull is strong and smart. He will rejoin the herd when it suits him. One day he will reappear. That is his way. We have been working in land without water, and the heat of the day is hard upon us. Horses and men are edgy with thirst, so instead of returning directly to the village, we ride southeast to the nearest accessible point of Sibikyu Creek. As it happens, this is trail goes down between two hills, the place where Old Man Owl was shown to be a fool by the two Apache sisters. It is wonderfully cool beside the stream, and everyone drinks his fill. Sam Enfield, wearing his pants and hat, decides to go for a dip. Charles Cromwell, whose tender modesties preclude displays of unclad flesh, ambles off behind a thick stand of willow bushes. And Dudley, having twice bathed his face and neck with his handkerchief, sits down beneath the cottonwood tree, whose massive lower limb dips to touch the ground. Joining him under the tree, I glance upward into its shade-filled branches, a wholly spontaneous act, to which he responds by slapping the ground and bursting into peals of high-pitched laughter. Sam stops splashing in the water and Charles, looking mildly alarmed, comes stumbling out of the willows, trying to button his fly. What is going on? Our ancestors did that, Dudley exclaims with undisguised glee. We all do that, even the women and children. We all look up to see her with her legs spread slightly apart. These places are really very good. Now you've drunk from one. Now you can work on your mind. Still laughing, the wary horseman takes off his sweat-soaked hat and places it on the ground beside him. Then he lies down, cradles his head in the crook of his arm, and goes soundly to sleep. Beneath the ancient cottonwood tree, the air is alive with humming insects. Sensing Places. If nothing else, this truncated tale of congenial Western Apaches, a distinctive brand of wisdom, and a locally infamous cottonwood tree should lend substance to the claim that sense of place, or as I would prefer to say, sensing of place, is a form of cultural activity. Though commonly viewed in different terms, as instinctual need by human ethnologists, as beneficial personality component by developmental psychologists, as mechanism of social integration by theoretical sociologists, sense of place, as I have made it out, is neither biological imperative, aid to emotional stability, nor means to group cohesiveness. What it is, as N. Scott Momaday has suggested, is a kind of imaginative experience, a species of involvement with the natural and social environment, a way of appropriating portions of the earth. While this perspective renders sense of place no less challenging to fathom or describe, it demystifies the notion by assigning it to the familiar province of everyday events. Removed from the spectral realm of scholastic reifications, needs, attributes, mechanisms, and the like, sense of place can be seen as a commonplace occurrence, as an ordinary way of engaging one's surroundings and finding them significant. Albert Camus may have said it best. Sense of place, he wrote, is not just something that people know and feel. It is something people do. And that realization brings the whole idea rather firmly down to earth, which is plainly, I think, where a sense of place belongs. A variety of experience, sense of place also represents a culling of experience. It is what has accrued and never stops accruing from lives spent sensing places, vaguely realized most of the time, and rarely brought forth for conscious scrutiny. It surfaces in an attitude of enduring affinity with known localities and the ways of life they sponsor. As such, it is greeted as natural, normal, and, despite the ambivalent feelings it sometimes produces, entirely unremarkable. Experience delivered neat, though not, as I say, always very neatly, sense of place is accepted as a simple fact of life, as a regular aspect of how things are, and if one were tempted to change it, which no one ever is, the effort would certainly fail. It is probable, of course, that your sense of place will center on localities different from mine, just as ours together will center on localities different from Ruth and Dudley Patterson's. But that each of us should be drawn to particular pieces of territory, and for reasons we take to be relatively uncomplicated, is radically expectable. A sense of place, everyone presumes, is everyone's possession. But sense of place is not possessed by everyone in similar manner or like configuration, and that pervasive fact is part of what makes it interesting. Like all the other senses we have invented for mankind, the aesthetic sense, the erotic sense, common sense, etc., sense of place is inseparable from the ideas that inform it, and just for that reason, as Lawrence Durrell remarked in a letter to a friend, it is everywhere parochial and everywhere specific. locked within the mental horizons of those who give it life, sense of place issues in a stream of symbolically drawn particulars, the visible particulars of local topographies, the personal particulars of biographical associations, and the notional particulars of socially given systems of thought. It is the latter, of course, that are at least available to conscious awareness, and perhaps for this reason, writers on place rarely see fit to examine them. Yet it is just these systems of thought that mold and organize the experience itself, and to casually ignore them, as so often happens, is to suppose that matters are much simpler than in fact they really are. You can no more imagine an Apache sense of place without some notion of old man owl, smooth minds, and what occurred at grasshoppers piled up across, than you can fancy a native New Yorker's sense of place without comparable ideas of Woody Allen contending with subway rush hours and Central Park on the first warm day of spring. Everything, or almost everything, hinges on the particulars, and because it does, ethnography is essential. For with any sense of place, the pivotal question is not where it comes from, or even how it gets formed, but what, so to speak, it is made with. Like a good pot of stew or a complex musical chord, the character of the thing emerges from the qualities of its ingredients, and while describing the character may prove troublesome indeed, always, it seems, there is something ineffable about it. The elements that compose it can be selectively sampled and separately assessed, which is what, in a roundabout way, I have tried to do here. Transformative spatial prefixes, disquisitions on wisdom, and cautionary stories on thirst-crazed women and puffed-up medicine men do not add up to a Western Apache's sense of place, but they can be used to construct one. And thus, taken together, they have something revealing to say about the quality of its tone and the substance of its style. They give us, in short, a sense of the Apache's sense, an appreciation of what goes into it, an informed perspective on the angle of its thrust, and also, I would add, a purchase of sorts on the wellsprings of its force. As vibrantly felt as it is vividly imagined, sense of place asserts itself at varying levels of mental and emotional intensity, whether it is lived in memory or experienced on the spot. The strength of its impact is commensurate with the richness of its contents, with the range and diversity of symbolic associations that swim within its reach and move it on its course. In its more ordinary moments, as Seamus Heaney has observed, sense of place stays within the sphere of its own familiar attractions, prompting individuals to dwell on themselves in terms of themselves, as private persons with private lives to ponder. But in its fuller manifestations, this separatist stance gives way to thoughts of membership in social groups, of participation in activities that transcend the concerns of particular people, of close involvements with whole communities and their enduring historical traditions. Experienced in this way, as what Heaney terms a mode of communion with a total way of living, sense of place may gather unto itself a potent religious force, especially if one considers the root of the word religare, which is to bind or to fasten fast. Fueled by sentiments of inclusion, belonging, and connectedness to the past, sense of place roots individuals in the social and cultural soils from which they have sprung together, holding them there in the grip of a shared identity, a localized version of selfhood. Self and mind, Baruch Spinoza wrote, are essentially one and the same. Assuming this claim to be true, it is hard to conceive of a cultural construct whose bearing on place could be more intimately related to ideas of selfhood than the Western Apache theory of wisdom and its sources. incorporating places and their meanings into a compact model of mental and social development, the theory of Igoyai proposes that the most estimable qualities of human minds, keen and unhurried reasoning, resistance to fear and anxiety, and suppression of emotions born of hostility